Good evening. I'm Cheryl Croucher, and you're listening to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. On this evening's show, you'll hear about Zymark, an Alberta company of materials scientists. They're doing really cool stuff to take the heat off the world's microprocessors. And among their client lists is the International Space Station. And talk about flying high. If you're an optimist like Holly Newman, you're already looking forward to spring and the return of those migrating songbirds. Holly's a visual artist who spent the winter creating 200 bird nests, and now she wants your help to finish a domestic experiment, something she calls the nesting project. And Dr. Doug Oram of the University of Alberta takes us back in time for a look at the life of Henry Marshall Torrey. Torrey was a founder of the University of Alberta, the Alberta Research Council, and he was a grand promoter of science and applied research. So just sit back and enjoy the next half hour as you listen to their stories on Innovation Alberta. You might be surprised to find out Alberta is a high-tech player in the space race. But up there, in orbit, where they're building the International Space Station, you'll find electronic components bearing the Zymark brand. Zymark is an Alberta company marketing technology developed by a group of Alberta materials scientists. I recently attended an open house at the Alberta Research Council, where Zymark manufactures its high-tech parts for clients around the globe. Now, spread before me was an array of tiny computer chips and electronic components, but sales director Dan Dukic was quick to point out that the important part was what he calls the really cool stuff under the chips.
Well, they're not computer chips per se. A computer chip typically would have intelligence and be active. What ours really are is more of we would refer to it as a substrate or a base layer of a package. And what we do is we would actually have these computer chips or some type of active component would be mounted onto these ceramics. Now, these ceramics, the reason they would use them is to remove heat from that electronic device. The reason you need to remove that heat is the heat reduces the life of the part. So we're helping to extend the life and improve the reliability of it.
What's innovative about this?
Well, the whole idea here is that we have the ability to put metal down on ceramic, and not necessarily just any ceramic, but aluminum nitride. Aluminum nitride has certain thermal properties that are very good at removing heat. This heat is what kills devices or electronic devices. So we have developed a variety of technologies on this particular ceramic. And there are other ceramics that we do work on as well that give you either strength-wise they're better, or maybe you do not need as, it does not necessarily have to be as thermally conductive, as we call it. But all in all, it's a technology that's relatively new. There aren't a lot of companies in the world today that actually use this material.
Is this something new that's been developed in Alberta?
The technology is fairly new, and a lot of the technology was developed in Alberta. Zymark itself actually purchased a portion of that technology and equipment from another company and moved forward with it. In fact, many of us within Zymark actually were with the other company. So the technology, the core people that have been working on this have been working on this for at least the last 6 years.
So what was the problem that you were trying to get at in that kind of motivated the development of this?
Really, it was the issue of removing heat or the need to remove heat. And that issue really developed as electronics started to shrink. As you put more intelligence or you put more processing capability within a smaller area, there's more heat generated. That heat is basically what kills the electronics. So the industry was looking for ways to actually remove that heat that would be more effective, would also be smaller, I guess, too, to help in miniaturization. And that's where our material science background comes in handy.
Now, where would this be used?
Well, there are a wide range of applications for it. typically we our parts end up in aerospace applications or industrial, transportation, also commercial. You may find it, basically, if I were to go into more detail, some of our parts have actually made it into the International Space Station, the transit systems, basically for electric trains in Boston and in the San Francisco Bay Area. Also, our parts work their way into things like cell phone base stations or even a cell phone. And we also are moving into the automotive market for electric vehicles, things like that.
How does it actually work then? You were showing or telling me earlier that it almost disappears. Is that the case?
Well, it doesn't. Well, the heat actually either spreads or it moves away. It's drawn away from the source of the heat. So the idea is that it has a high thermal conductivity, which means it manages heat very well. It can cool off. I think one of the ways to describe it is you could take a piece of this material, put it in an oven, bake it for 10 minutes at 400 degrees Celsius, pull it out, set it down on a cold surface, and immediately touch it with your fingers. That's how quickly it will cool down.
Do you have people from all over the world clamoring for this?
You bet. In fact, most of our clientele is, in fact, international. We basically have a few customers in Canada, and we are growing that market as the need arises. But most of our business is actually in the U.S., in the Far East, and in Europe.
Zymark, what's that name come from?
Well, we wanted a .com, and as you know, a .com is pretty hard to come across anymore on the web. So we decided we had to be very cryptic in how we came up with our name. And if we were to get right down to it, ARC is the initials of Alberta Research Council. It also could mean arcing, you know, problems that are usually created by heat. And Zeme or Zima really is a Slavic term, and since there's lots of Slavic people around in Alberta, it kind of was a neat fit. We were looking for something that meant cold and hot, or some sort of derivative of that, and that's how we came up with Zymark.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Dan Dukic is Director of Sales for Zymark. You can check out the company's website at zymark.com. Coming up, a blending of nature, science, and the visual arts. These are some birds that I recorded at 4 a.m. one spring morning on the shores of Beaver Lake up near Lac La Biche. So that's why I perked up when I saw a notice on a bulletin board at the university advertising something called the Nesting Project. So I ventured down into the cavernous fringe gallery situated below the paint spot on White Avenue in Edmonton. And what I found was a wall completely covered with 200 bird nests of all colors and shapes. It took visual artist Holly Newman all winter to hand make each nest.
It was a project that began one day when my daughter observed the birds flying away for the fall. And she said, "But Mommy, will they come back?" Because she was so concerned of their leaving. And I said, "Of course, in the spring they will." Well, she was doubtful. And I think maybe with good cause, because we never really know where they go or how well they're taken care of. So I had this idea of welcoming them back in spring and encouraging them to nest in the city, a place where normally we don't think that we want to invite things. And so I made birds' nests, 200 of them, because I thought I needed to make lots and put them out and hope that people would be willing to adopt them.
Now, tell me what you've made them out of.
They're made out of fabric. Most of it would be familiar with quilters. Usually it's a wool or cotton. Some of it's been crocheted. And then they've been elaborated with beads and ribbons and various forms of decoration.
Well, looking at them, it looks like every single one of these 200 nests is different.
I tried to make them different, which was getting a little harder near the end. But the fabric themselves often inspired, you know, certain sorts of details and whatnot. So, yeah, I think everyone is different.
Now, it's wonderful to look at all of these nests up on the walls, but you want people to come and actually use them and try them out. Tell me about the science behind this.
What I'm hoping, it's a very sort of casual science. I call it a domestic experiment, because what I'm hoping is people will take them, think about where a nest would go in their yard, think about what a bird needs to make a good home in the city, things like predators, you know, good shelter, food, water, and choose that site. Come to me on the 31st of January here at the Fringe Gallery and take one or two home and just see what happens over the spring and summer. Then I take them back in the fall, and I've photographed every one of them, and I will do a comparison just to see what's been left and what's been changed according to the bird's needs.
For people who are living outside of Edmonton, can they partake in this as well?
They absolutely can. I'm willing to ship them to people one way, but I'm hoping that they'll be willing to ship them back to me. And so it's sort of an exchange and a shared cost that way.
For the amount of work that's gone into this and then what you expect to do with it over time, it seems to me that you must be terribly driven by this project. Tell me about that. What's it like as an artist and mixing these different mediums and thoughts and philosophies about the world?
It's really been invigorating for me, and that's part of, like you say, being driven. So for me, it has been an energy of recognizing that I wanted to draw people into my work, that I didn't want people who would normally just come and passively observe art. I wanted people who would be willing to participate, not just the people, but the birds. So I'm trying to see just how far I can push an idea and open it up to a community and see if they're willing to participate, or if maybe people do enjoy being a passive observer.
Now, I'm looking at this from person's point of view, but I'm also thinking, I wonder what a bird would think from a bird's eye view of the nest. What have you found with the people who have come and said, well, I'll take this one, I'll take that one?
Most people do seem to be attracted to the shiny little object ones, the ones with lots of little colorful detail and delicate sort of coloring. But if they're a birder, they tend to be more attracted to the darker and the more neutral toned ones. So it sort of depends on their own experience, I think, with birds in their own yard and the nests that they've put up. So it's been very interesting to see how people respond to it.
What are you going to do with the information after you get it back from everybody in the fall?
It will form a document, because I'm also hoping to get some anecdotal evidence back from people telling me what they observed, and you know, maybe they weren't successful in having a nest, but they saw the birds pick away at the beads, or you know, just showing general interest. So I'm hoping to get that kind of anecdotal evidence from people who have put them up, and then I'll compile that with the photographed documentation of the bird's nest in their original form, along with the altered nests, as well as those. It'll note which ones went missing for whatever reason. I've been told that squirrels might be, you know, interested in carrying them off or making them their home or nibbling at them. So it'll be curious to see just what elements have the most impact.
Now, I'm just looking at these and trying to think which one I would like to take and put up in my yard, because what I'd like to do is follow along through the summer, and we can report on this on Innovation Alberta and see how things carry on. I don't know where to begin. There's so many. Like this one, this interesting orange crochet one, reminds me of a purse I had in the 1960s.
There's that sense of memory that's attached to fabric that I think is part of the domestic side of the experiment. You know, sort of bringing what's inside our home outside and seeing if it is successful as sort of a found material for birds, because they often do use things found in their environment. I've seen them fly by fluttering with a piece of plastic in their beak, you know, and so they're able to use what maybe they wouldn't find traditionally in the environment, and I'm curious to see whether they'll accept what we have inside our homes.
Well, thank you very much. If anything, it's beautiful to look at, and it's certainly a tribute to the amount of detail and work that you've done.
Thank you so much, Cheryl.
Holly Newman is a visual artist. The fabric nests are on display at the Fringe Gallery at 106th Street and White Avenue in Edmonton. If you want to participate in the nesting project, you have until January 31st to reserve your choice of nests, and you can contact Holly at hnewman@attcanada.ca. Now, let's head back in time to 1906, when Henry Marshall Tory first set his sights on Alberta. The first president of the University of Alberta was a man named Henry Marshall Tory. He's been called the most important Canadian educator of his time. He promoted science with the passion of an evangelist, and he founded the Alberta Research Council and turned the National Research Council into a major scientific institution. I spoke about Tory's life with Dr. Doug Oram, a history professor and the academic vice president and provost of the University of Alberta. Doug authored the foreword to the reprinting of E.A. Corbett's biography of Henry Marshall Tory's life.
Tory's biography is, interestingly, as I say in the foreword, somewhat opaque about his personal life. But here's a person whose career took paths that wouldn't have been expected and went a long way. He began out of a farm family in Nova Scotia. I gather not a terribly well-off one. He taught school in Nova Scotia, decided he didn't like teaching school, and went to McGill University, where he excelled as a professor. Also, he started off assuming he would move into religion. He thought he would be ordained to become a Methodist minister. He got a long way down that road and then decided he didn't want to be a Methodist minister. He didn't have the faith to do it, and moved into science as almost an alternate religion, although a lot of his motivation and work ethic came out of his religious roots.
Now, why science?
That's a good question. I think it's partly the age. Tory was an age when a lot was happening in science. When he was a child, the Darwinian Revolution was underway with, of course, the whole reshaping of what you're thinking about in the world. A lot of activity was going along around, especially in the area of physics and other things, around the nature of the atom and the nature of the universe around the atom. Tory, I think, saw in science some of the hard evidence that many other people saw as very attractive as a different way of looking at the world than religion. If you went back 50 years before Tory started his career, people talked about the sciences as natural theology, which is an interesting way of putting it. It means that you look at it starting off from the religious perspective and come down to the physical world. By the time Tory came in, they'd reverse that. We're beginning to see science or empirical evidence as the way you approach the world. And I think Tory was caught up in this new excitement. And certainly for him, it seemed to be the way he wanted to look at the world and the way he carried on his career.
So how did he end up here in Alberta?
This is a long story. I'll try to be fairly brief. Tory was at McGill, and McGill University, along with the University of Toronto and to a lesser extent Queen's, were really the major universities in Canada at the time, major being all of 2,000 students or so. British Columbia was expanding rapidly in a boom in the late 19th, early 20th century, as was much of the West, and began to feel a need for some form of higher education, but didn't feel it had the resources to have a full-blown university. So McGill offered to create a branch campus in Vancouver, and Tory was sent west to create that branch campus and to establish, in a sense, what became the University of British Columbia, although at that time it was called McGill University in British Columbia.
So from there, he ended up in Alberta. Was he on this sort of mission to go around starting universities everywhere?
That became his mission. I don't think he thought of it that way at the time. After he finished his work in British Columbia, at least round one, he came back through Alberta, visited Edmonton. He talked to a minister named Riddell, who was head of Alberta College, which at the time was a kind of, we would think of it more as a normal school or advanced high school sort of training that was going on, partly for people going into the ministry and so on. And it was a Methodist college as well. He was interested in what was going on in Edmonton, but then went back to McGill and I think thought that he would be back in the East. But as Alberta became a province, after Alberta became a province in 1905, which is about the same time Tory was doing his work in British Columbia, Alberta, too, began to think about having a university. Now, Tory had a couple of concerns which led him to write the Premier of Alberta. The Premier of Alberta, named Rutherford, also happened to be a McGill graduate. And he writes him, he says, as one old McGill alumnus to another, he then put a series of propositions about what a university should be. Tory's interesting because, for all his religious background, he was really afraid of religious universities. He felt you should not have denominational universities, that was not the way of the 20th century, and it must be avoided. And he was afraid that Alberta might make the wrong choices. So he kind of volunteered to the Premier these issues, and the Premier responded by, in a sense, asking him to come west, not to set up a McGill campus, but to set up an independent campus.
But did he have a political battle at that time, considering that you have this sort of secularism versus the theological view of what learning should be?
He certainly had a big battle in British Columbia. There was a huge outcry from two different groups. One was a religious group that felt the British Columbia Institution, whatever it is, should evolve from their own institution. But he also had a battle in British Columbia because a bunch of University of Toronto graduates didn't want a McGill model to contaminate the West. And in fact, there's great correspondence there about effete Easterners coming West and wrecking British Columbia. But in Alberta, as far as I can see, while there was some issues, he worked much better with the local Methodist college here and was able to get around the pitfalls. The big battle in Alberta was actually about what city the university should be in, and that may not be surprising to Albertans.
So the old Edmonton-Calgary battle goes way, way back still.
Oh, it sure does. And at that time, you happen to have a Liberal government in Alberta, and if for people who know Alberta politics, that usually means an Edmonton-based government, and it's no exception here. The capital of the province was named Edmonton because the premier of the province was a Liberal and because the prime minister of the day was a Liberal, and the university was put in Edmonton for that reason as well. But Calgary was absolutely furious.
So did Tory always have a battle with Calgary?
Tory spent a lot of time when he was establishing the new University of Alberta and trying to explain to Calgary why it was a good thing for the whole province and so on. But there were individuals in Calgary who never forgave him. In particular, a man named R.B. Bennett, who was at that time leader of the Conservative opposition in Alberta, and who later, of course, became Prime Minister of Canada. So there was a long history of antipathy with Calgary around this issue, and Tory got blamed for some of it.
But he managed to convince Rutherford that there should be a new model for a university here in Alberta. He was invited to come and get it going. How did he approach that, and how did he take his view of the sciences then and bring that into this new university?
I think, yeah, there's two or three things that are very important there. First of all, it is the new model, as you said, of a state university. And by that I mean that this is deliberately kept away from any particular religious denomination or church control. If you went to Queen's University or the University of Toronto's colleges, although the University of Toronto was a federated system, all of them were in one way or another connected to a church. And what Tory said is we should not be connected to a church. This is here to serve the whole community and must be essentially, I won't say secular, because in this age they assumed it was a Christian university, but not tied to any particular view of Christianity. And so Tory set up with a new model in which the university was a community university, number one, and that meant a very heavy place for what he saw as the modern issues, the modern disciplines, and that meant the sciences and the social sciences.
Well, if we can skip ahead a few years, once he got the different faculties established, he also was instrumental in getting the Alberta Research Council started. What was involved there?
Well, I think that's a very interesting story, the Alberta Research Council. New provinces, whether it was Saskatchewan or Alberta or British Columbia or Manitoba a few years earlier, want to try and set up an infrastructure in which they have all the accoutrements of a modern state, if I can put it that way. They want to prove they're not just a pioneer frontier, but that they're moving to the next stage. That's one of the reasons for a university in the first place. It's not that they have a huge demand locally, it's that you want to show you're important, you have a university. And I think that there was this tremendous sense of reform and progressivism in the West, and one of the notions behind that was modern scientific technique. And the idea of a research council to further these ideas was very much appealing to the local politicians and the population. Tory, with his tremendous belief in science, believed that this foundation should be linked to the university and very much involved in the tie between university research and what we would call applied research. He believed it on both sides. He believed that the university should reach out into the community, as I said, with practical solutions, and he therefore believed in an institute which could carry forward a more practical, if I could put that in quotation marks, a practical kind of research, focus on solutions and problems faced in a modern frontier society.
But someone has to fund that, and I think if you look at the times, this is coming out of the First World War, and people do have a different view of the need for technology and science and efficiency, and also looking to it to see that there is a business or economic opportunity there. How did that tie into things for Tory?
Well, I think that's important. Now, Tory was a progressive, and that phrase wraps up a lot of ideology. And it believes the great phrase used for progressivism is often efficiency and uplift. Efficiency meaning you use the most modern scientific techniques to get to the answers to solutions. Uplift meaning you're trying to improve the condition of society through that. So if you think of that, science as the road to improvement. If you can make that argument to a group that's already half convinced, you'll get the money to go with it. Because what you see is both businesses will see direct profit for them with better products and better solutions. The politicians will see improvement in various social or scientific issues more usually that can be solved through this. And so I think it all came together in one package in Tory's mind and in Rutherford's mind.
He seemed to be one of those people, though, who could take an idea and then just really make it come to fruition. Where other people might fail and stumble, he made it all happen. He traveled all over the place. He talked to people everywhere and got them enthused to the point that they would put up the facilities and the money for it. Why was that?
Torrey's been called a builder by his biographer, E.A. Corbett, and I think that's a way to put it. If you look at Torrey's whole career, he starts with the University of British Columbia, he then comes to the University of Alberta. He later in his life, after the Alberta Research Council, will go off to the National Research Council, and then finally to Carleton University, or Carleton College, as it was at the time. Torrey's real strength seemed to be to take an idea and to turn it into something concrete, to bring the people behind it and the resources behind it. It's interesting, he could be pretty much of an infighter if he had to be, to keep off of differing views, and it's one side of him which is understated in the writings on him, but it's certainly there, a person who could sort of do battle in the corners with people if he had to push them aside to get his own vision implemented. So he seemed good at being able to articulate the vision, implement the vision, and fight off people with different views. But that's what he liked doing. He liked to build. He didn't like to manage once he was finished with it. After a while, he got bored and go off to something else.
You mentioned the National Research Council. Tell me about the time there, because that's quite interesting. This is an Alberta institution that becomes a federal one rather than the other way around.
Well, it's sort of, the Alberta Research Council is a model for the National Research Council. The National Research Council existed before Torrey joined it on paper. It was kind of a scholarship organization. It didn't do much else, but it did give out some scholarships for people doing research in science. But the federal government was looking for it to do something more, and it looked west, and it looked at Torrey and his accomplishments at the Alberta Research Council and at the University of Alberta, and asked him to come in and start to manage what at that time was just a part-time job. He had such an energetic approach to building a meaningful research council in Ottawa that it soon became a full-time job, and in fact, he left Alberta in 1928 to go down to Ottawa and manage the National Research Council full-time. It's interesting, by the way, that when he left, he was 65 years old. At a time when most people are thinking of retiring, he's heading off on a whole new career. But he built the National Research Council into one of the more significant scientific agencies in North America, or the world for that matter, as a centrally funded agency to pursue practical research.
Sitting here in 2001, and you look back, 80 years to the time when the Research Council was brought in and the university is already well established here. What is your final summation on the life of this man, who he was, and what he represents to Albertans today heading into this new millennium?
Well, first I'd say Torrey's legacy is still being felt. It's being felt in the culture of both the universities, both the University of Alberta and the University of Calgary. Much of their shape and emphasis reflect Torrey's original vision of what a university should be. Secondly, not just in the Alberta Research Council, but in other things that have evolved in Alberta over the years, Torrey's notion of science that makes sense to the community and reaches out to the community is also very present. So it's surprising how the legacy has continued. Also, I think down in Ottawa, the National Research Council is still a major player in Canada and is still a model around the world. And that, too, is part of Torrey's legacy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Doug Oram, history professor, vice president academic, and provost at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to an end for this week. I'd like to hear about what you're doing, the research projects you're working on, or your creative inventions. Just send an email to CherylCroucher@ckua.org. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. Good night.